Blog Talk Radio.
What difference if I hail from north or south, or from the east or west? My heart is filled with love for all of these. I only know I swell with pride and deep within my breast I thrill to see, oh glory, faint the breeze.
Five generals, both Allied and a Nazi, who were born in November. And they are Patton, General Patton, November 11th, and I think 1897. There was Field Marshal Rommel, Erwin Rommel, who was born, I think, November 15th or 14th. Then we had Bernard Law Montgomery, was part of that Anglo-Irish, what is known as the Anglo-Irish generals in World War II in the British Army. And those were Field Marshal Alexander, who was in charge of Commander-in-Chief of the Mediterranean campaign. That was Italy, North Africa, Cyprus, Greece, that part. We had Montgomery. And these were the English who had gone to Ireland about the time of Cromwell, and they were descendants of those families. Although Montgomery may have been may have had some French background, Montgomery, but we're looking at it. Then also we have Charles de Gaulle, whose birthday is next week, and then we have a Nazi general, Erich von Manstein. Next week we're going to have a surprise. Did Hitler have a general who may have had Jewish background? Something I recently come across. It's fascinating, and it might have a connection to an American president, his escapades. Anyway, we'll get into that next week. Hopefully we'll have this problem fixed with Yahoo. A lot of people have been having problems with it, and I have had problems with it on Blog Talk. Warren Harding was the president-elect after Woodrow Wilson, This was the only election, 1920 election, was the only election in American politics where both of the candidates were not lawyers. They were both newspaper publishers. James Cox was the Democratic nominee, and Franklin Delano Roosevelt was his vice presidential candidate. And they were both from Ohio, both from different parts of Ohio, and both were newspaper publishers. And then Warren Harding was a U.S. senator, and he coined some awful words like normalcy, it's normality, and bloviating. In fact, that word was recently used, I think, by Mr. Obama. I may be mistaken on that. Well, Montgomery is very interesting. Getting back to him, the Rommel was kicking British butt in North Africa, and he was called the Africa Corps was set up by Hitler. It was sent over as kind of an expeditionary force to assist Mussolini's Italians, who were having a difficult time with the Brits. The British were under the command of Field Marshal General Auchinleck, and then there was General O'Connor. And then the British were beating the Italians, and so Mussolini, who was old favorites by Hitler, requested military assistance, and they sent over General Rommel. Now, Rommel made his – he was a career officer, Protestant Lutheran, and he made his name in the war with France in 1940, that his was the fastest division to enter France and to overcome military, achieve military objectives. And so Hitler raised him from general, from I think colonel to a general, and then with his success, which the British referred to him as the Desert Fox, to field marshal. And he was one of several field marshals in the Nazi Wehrmacht. And of course, the Navy equivalent rank was Grand Admiral. We'll get into that another day. Anyway, Montgomery had some interesting views. He had survived. He was a career officer. His father, I think, was an Anglican priest or bishop, clergyman. He had served in World War One, and he was wounded in the trenches. In fact, he was caught in a trench. I think he was wounded, and a sniper kept firing at him, and another guy fell over, a sergeant, I believe, fell over Montgomery's body. And he took all the hits, and Montgomery got it in the knee or the leg. Anyway, Montgomery saw the horrible slaughter on the Somme. I don't know if Colonel Hodges, who was Lieutenant Hodges at the time, Trevor Hodges, who we've talked about several times on this show, knew Montgomery or had met him when he was in the trenches in World War One in the Battle of the Somme after he came back and survived Gallipoli. Anyway, Montgomery then served in Ireland about the time of Michael Collins and when the Irish were trying to get independence from Britain. That had been a long fight, and that struggle has a connection to the Steve Nery case and to the San Francisco former district attorney Terrence Hallinan, whose grandfather, Patrick Hallinan, was part of a Irish terrorist group called the Invincibles, and they were involved in the assassination of Lord Cavendish, who was an emissary sent over by the British Prime Minister to try to broker a peace treaty. This has never worked with the British or the Swedes. There's a case in Palestine where a Swedish officer, nobleman, came over to try to get a truce between the British and the Jews who and Israelis and the Arabs who were fighting, weren't Israelis at the time, but which trying to get establish a Jewish state, and he was assassinated in Palestine, as it was called then. Anyway, Patrick Hallinan was in Lord Cavendish is famous because his grandson married Adele Astaire, the sister of Fred Astaire. And just fascinating, there is another connection to the Steve Nery case and San Francisco. There's a lot of threads in history, people. You wouldn't believe it. But anyway, Montgomery came up with he came to the conclusion that Britain ought to give self-independence to the Irish. That political thinking was not popular and was politically incorrect. So we didn't hear any more from Montgomery. Later, after he was he took over from Auchinleck in North Africa and the famous British Eighth Army. In fact, a march has been written by the British Sousa called Kenneth Alford. He wrote the Bridge on the River Kwai March and the Eighth Army March to honor Montgomery and the British Eighth Army, which beat Rommel, and Rommel was out of North Africa. He was in Germany on sick leave. Montgomery had gotten all of what was it, 1,000 guns, American tanks, and he had retrained the British Eighth Army to get out of its defeatist mood and to think as winners. And at the Battle of El Alamein, which is his hallmark, he defeated. Rommel was not there, but he defeated the Africa Corps and drove them all the way back to Tobruk and eventually reconquered Tobruk. When the invasion of Western Europe was planned, the British could not, Montgomery thought he should be supreme commander, but we were supplying all the money and all the tanks and the food and the ships and all most of that. And so he had to take the secondary position as commander of the ground forces, and I guess General Bradley was under him. But and then Montgomery took the surrender of the well. Those of you who've seen the movie A Bridge Too Far, this was Montgomery's great tactical error, where they on paper it sounded great, typical of the British. But execution was quite another matter. They screwed up with the equipment. The equipment the radios didn't work. The planes couldn't come in to deliver the guns and all the military hardware that they needed to defeat the Germans. If they had had that they might have overtaken all five bridges over the Rhine and shortened the war maybe by a year. That was the plan. But I recommend, if you haven't seen that movie, A Bridge Too Far, it's very accurate, very bloody. Richard Attenborough did it, was producer and director of the film. He also did Gandhi. I highly recommend it if you're interested in military history. It's a very good movie, and it's a beautiful soundtrack to it also. But Montgomery, after the war, he was elevated to a nobility called Viscount, and he was very upset and very disturbed about homosexuality in the British forces. And it has been known, Churchill made this statement, that the British Navy was known for rum, sodomy, and the lash. They were one of the last navies in the world to eliminate flogging. And, of course, even to this day, American Navy is dry. There's no liquor or wine, I understand, or beer on the ships. But the British have their rum ration every day. And, of course, punishment can be if you denied your rum ration. And this goes back several hundred years, the rum ration. But Montgomery, the British soldiers, especially the Grenadier Guards who guard the palace, had a bad reputation for doing engaging in prostitution when they were off duty, and they did this to earn more money. And Montgomery was very upset about this and made statements that he opposed legalizing homosexuality. And there was nothing said about lesbianism. In fact, I knew a woman, dear friend, I worked with her daughter in 1968-69. She was in the British Eighth Army, an unusual woman. Her father was the British Consul General here in San Francisco, and she had married a Dutchman because she felt sorry for him, but she had been in the British Eighth Army in North Africa during World War II when she had dual citizenship. Great lady. She retired to Canada. I used to visit her. But anyway, she had some interesting things to say about Montgomery. Now, Montgomery is one of the controversial. His sexuality is controversial. He was married. He had a son. He hated his mother. There was no love lost there. And he had what was on the surface, a friendly relation with a 12-year-old Swiss boy. He used to write letters, and they're pictures documented of him, and people are raising the issue because he was a teetotaler and didn't smoke and he didn't allow alcohol. He drank tea and kind of a vegetarian. So, you know, all these guys except for Patton, who was a two-fisted drinker and a curser, enjoyed French wine, spoke French, was a connoisseur. And, of course, he came from a wealthy family. he was thought of as kind of, I guess the word would be odd. And so there's this controversy. Now, we're going to be, in the next couple of weeks, putting up our research on military men throughout history who have been gay or bisexual. It's quite interesting, and they had made contributions to military science, to war, and to society, and they just had this other side of their life, which they didn't politicize. Of course, Ernest Röhm, the World War One German Army hero who worked with Hitler and brought Hitler to power, was an open homosexual. He set up the what was called the SA. I can never pronounce that long German name, and it was primarily homosexual. They engaged in orgies, extortion, public rowdiness, and became a little too ambitious, and Hitler decided to play him off against Himmler, who was a Catholic, brought up a Catholic, but like a lot of them, as Hitler didn't live up to the precepts of the church, of the faith, and they were horrible people, and Himmler hated homosexuals, even though there were some in the SS. One of the people in the case that I've been working on for 15 years, the Stephen Nairn case, U.S. Navy sailor, one of the people who have supported our efforts, she's a U.S. Army nurse, now retired. One of her uncles was in the SS, although she's an American. Some strange people, in a lot of the connections that I have made and have been connected to in my lifetime. But Montgomery was fascinating, and of course, we'll do something on General Patton and General Billy Mitchell, whom I admired his views and courage. Those will be coming up, and then there'll be this surprise on this German general who may have really been Jewish, or at least born that way, born into that faith. Just as an aside, some of you have probably heard of the latest lunacy coming out of San Francisco, where we have what I call the lavender left, the gay, lesbian, homosexual politicos who are now trying to ban all circumcision, and it goes further than that. This has been going on. It's never been picked up in the mainstream press, but the idea that the people, males who have been circumcised, can restore that. There's these, quote, restoral services, and it's just the whole thing's really crazy. But people are getting tired of all this lunacy, but this is now making news in a variety of papers that the San Francisco Board of Supervisors, as we call them, are now going to vote on. Half of them are gay. We don't know about that one woman who's on there, a black woman who may or may not be a lesbian. We don't know. But we do have open gays and closeted gays on that board who go along with this agenda, and people are getting tired of what I call crotch politics. Today, also, since we're talking about the military, did you know that the Selective Service Act is still on the books, and young men immigrants and aliens who are in this country have to register with American Selective Service. They have 6 months to do it by 6 months after their 18th birthday. And if they're applying for a student, if they haven't complied with the Selective Service Registration Act, if they apply for student loans, federal housing loans, any federal program, and to hold any federal office or employment, they are they're disqualified. And if they violated that and got the money anyway, the funds, they can be sued under QUITAM. Now, we have a famous case, came out of this crazy city, San Francisco. President Clinton appointed Roberta Achtenberg, an upfront, very aggressive lesbian, who was on the San Francisco Board of Supervisors. She has a law degree from, of all places, the Mormon University, University of Utah. She's very big in this real estate racketeering. Anyway, she had an aide named Alexander Clements. She brought him to HUD, but when he filled out papers and they checked his background, as they're supposed to for all federal employees, they found out he hadn't registered for the draft. He is also gay, but he was still required to register for the Selective Service. So he got fired. So a lot of people have preferred to forget about that or have forgotten about that, but the law is still on the books, and there are people who have not registered and who are openly defiant of all federal law. So keep that in mind. So any lawyers out there, you that's another thing. To file a quitam suit, which is a lawsuit, a civil lawsuit, to sue people who may have illegally received or tried to receive or were received federal funds and not accounted for them, they can be sued. It's the only federal lawsuit that requires a licensed attorney. You cannot do a pro pair on this. There's a famous case called, I forgot, it's 1950 case. I'll bring it up again because people have been asking how can they sue people involved in public corruption, which involves federal funds. There's also a state of California section on what they call False Claims Act. That's the, another term for quitam. Anyway, that comes up. Now, on California's, we have one race in California, statewide race, the state attorney general's position, and there's nobody can understand how this woman, Harris, who is seen as an incompetent and she's embraced the gay, lesbian, NAMBLA agenda politically, how she could amass all these votes when she, when there were scandals all through that office, the San Francisco District Attorney, and these scandals go back to 1920, where there was bribery. In one case, there may have been a murder, extortion, all kinds, and currently there were people who were involved in male prostitution working in the San Francisco District Attorney's office. One of them may have retired, but anyway. Nobody understands how she could amass all these votes and manage to tie up the state attorney general's race here in California. Well, what happened in San Francisco and in Northern California? It's a lot of vote fraud. The most rampant that we saw goes back to the Gore-Bush presidential campaign, where the big song at that time was Macarena. Well, what had happened in Los Angeles County, SEIU and the Alinsky people registered to vote absentee down there, and then there were buses supplied by Greyhound, because we've seen the campaign contributions expenditure. They came up to Northern California, registered absentee up here, and voted absentee, and then disappeared. So we suspect this is what may have happened in this election down there. And we refer to it, Californians Against Voter Fraud referred to it as the Macarena Express. And that was one of the controversies about the Democrats trying to steal the election. This is not the first time, but it's happened before. Also today, since we're talking about public corruption, Boss Tweed, the guy who started the Tammany Hall racket in New York City in the late 1800s, he was convicted by a district attorney whose birthday I share. It's just kind of interesting. Or birthday, not date. Anyway, he was sentenced to 12 years in prison. And the Tammany Hall, as we've heard about it, does not exist. I think the last guy was Carmine DiSapio. People who are from New York might remember that name. But Tammany Hall has essentially been destroyed, as a lot of the political machines across the country. And one of the what I call political fictions has been that Richard Daley created a political machine in Cook County. He didn't. He inherited a machine from Cermak, Anton Cermak, the guy who was assassinated with FDR down in Florida. In a subsequent criminal trial, 30 days, Giuseppe Zangara, who was the assassin, was tried, convicted, and executed within 30 days, all within 30 days, the fastest administration or maladministration of justice. It has been said that Cermak was fighting with the Irish for control of Chicago and Cook County politics. He was part of the Bohemians, and then they had the Kelly mob, which was the Irish. And in fact, the Irish hated the British for a lot of reasons because of the abuses in Northern Ireland. And one mayor, Big Bill Thompson, who was Republican and corrupt as hell, and connected to Al Capone. He went into the Irish wards of Chicago and said, if King George, there was no George on the throne at the time, comes to Chicago, I'll punch him in the nose. And so he got elected mayor in those Irish wards. And when he died, they found shoeboxes just full of big dollar bills large denominations in his closet. He wasn't the only Illinois politician. But Anton Cermak was down in Florida with FDR, and Giuseppe Zangara, who was supposedly connected to the mafia, and some said he was an anarchist, shot at the car that Roosevelt and Cermak were riding in, and Cermak took the hit. And before he died, he said, "Frank, I'm glad it was me and not you." But some people, you know, they think it was an attempted assassination on FDR, but it wasn't. Others say it was to get rid of Cermak. And after Cermak was out of the way, the Bohemians did not get the power, political power in Chicago, and became Irish, all up and up, right up, with the exception of Harold Washington was black. But it said that he had an Irish ancestor in his lineage. And even the woman, Jane Byrne, was Irish Catholic. But all the mayors had been Irish ethnics and Catholics since Cermak. But Richard Daley was an accountant, and he was in the Adlai Stevenson administration. There's a lot not known about Richard Daley at first. Interesting man. I had met him and did some, when I was a student, did some work, passing out literature, until I knew better. But anyway, he was an accountant, and ironically, he and George Christopher, the mayor of San Francisco, they were buddies. They were both accountants. And in the interview I did with George Christopher, I didn't put it up on the air. And of course, you can go to Amicus Veritas, AmicusVeritas YouTube, and I have several interviews. And when George Christopher brought the Giants to San Francisco, how he lured them, that's up there. And we'll be putting up more. His birthday's coming up in December, and he was the greatest mayor of this city, of San Francisco, and one of the last honest, ethical, and competent mayors. We've had a bunch of boobs ever since, and that includes Dianne Feinstein. but anyway, George, Mayor George, as I used to call him, we were buddies. Well, we were friends anyway. I used to go to lunch, and he helped support Veritas USA, our newspaper. He used to say that whenever he flew into O'Hare Field, that Richard Daley had a car waiting for him. They would meet for lunch and discuss accounting and how to run a city. So it's a strange political relationships. Anyway, today, let's see what else we have. So the voter fraud, getting back to that, here in San Francisco, as I said on several occasions, working with Californians Against Voter Fraud, a voluntary organization, that in the election before last, there were boxes of ballots from Hunters Point and the black districts, and they were being transported by, believed to be, San Francisco County sheriff's deputies. Somehow, some of those boxes ended up floating in San Francisco Bay. Apparently, the damn fools, whoever did this, did not put enough rocks to sink it to the bottom of the bay. So what happened was some of the boxes broke open or just came apart, and ballots were floating in San Francisco Bay. A couple of weeks ago, during the November election, ballots, we had two incidents that we know about, that ballots were found in by the Palace of Fine Arts in a rich district of San Francisco where they were found in a pond. In another instance, a San Francisco election precinct official came into a precinct where people were voting, and he just grabbed ballots and took them with him and fled. So I don't know what his fate is, but this is really blatant. They don't even do this stuff in Chicago or New York. But all the political machines we know of, the Green Machine in Philadelphia, the Curley Machine in Boston, Prendergast Machine in Kansas City, and then the Duplessis up in Montreal, Canada. He was known as Marcel Duplessis was the longest serving mayor in Canada, something like 25, 30 years. He had a thug police force, and he was known as the Richard Daley of Canada. But all of these political machines, as we know, as we have heard of, are all gone. What we do have are these so-called progressives who are a cross between communists and what I call national socialists. You know, that's the name for the Nazis. And they're promoting some of the same propaganda, some of the same programs, some of the same racism and sexual behavior as Hitler and Ernest Röhm. We will be doing something on doctors under Hitler. It's fascinating what's like these death panels and how people were treated. And incidentally, one of the things that the Nazis did not tolerate when they checked applicants for Nazi positions like the SS, they checked them for evidence of circumcision. Now, also, getting back to this foreskin restoral, during the Nazi extermination or attempted extermination of the Jews, or European Jews, some of the doctors and medical students did use foreskin restoral. I don't know how successful it was, but that did that's a medical art, I guess, that goes back to World War II. And this was a thing, in fact, those of you who saw the movie, what the heck was it, the series Herman Walk, The Winds of War, there's a scene in there where Americans are to board, going through Nazi-occupied Warsaw and to board a train to get to either go to Vienna, to go to Stockholm or Berlin. They demanded all the Jews, and there were people leaving from all of the countries that were whose citizens were leaving Nazi-occupied Poland. And they demanded all the Jews step forward, and they were separated. Well, the Americans in this series of I, Herman Walk refused to identify any Jews. Initially, some people were going to, and then they realized what they were doing and how they'd be ostracized. Then the SS captain says, well, we have ways. And then the American diplomat steps forward and says that circumcision is a common practice in American hospitals. So that's how that came up there. Those of you who've seen Winds of War with Robert Mitchum and what's her name? I forget. And who says she's got a Jewish grandmother. But anyway, that's interesting. Now, one of the screw-ups today has been this problem with YouTube. And so what we're going to do, we're going to end now because I'm having problems right now with this, not YouTube, but, excuse me, I'm a little sore, with Mozilla Firefox and, Yahoo, excuse me, a little tired here. So what we're going to do is end now, and I'm sorry about this, but I don't want this program to suddenly crash, so rather than do that, I'm going to end early, and we'll end with our politics and poker. Well, let's try it. I'm going to keep going as long as we can. We hear the term, and somebody asked me, would you repeat this? We hear the term lame duck session. So I did an interview with an editor, an author, and a former university president, Golden Gate University, went to Princeton. He was German ethnic, whose family emigrated to Canada. Then he went to Princeton University in New Jersey and then came out to San Francisco. So Otto Butz, this is the interview I did with him on animal illusions, and we get into the origin of ruptured duck. That's what we think the Democrats are, but lame duck session.
Hello again, my friends. Welcome to part two of our inaugural inquiry into animal rights and people's language. My guest today, again, is the eminent Otto Butz, president of Golden Gate University and what we call the house etymologist around here. Otto, after an election, both print and electronic journalists continually use the trite phrase, lame duck politician. As a political scientist, Otto, do you think that these journalists are really saying that our politicians are impotent, ruptured, and babbling incoherence?
Well, I think to some extent, yes. A lame duck, I guess, is a duck that can't fly very high, that can't move very fast. And once a politician has lost the power to continue functioning and to dole out favors, the person's power is much reduced, and so the analogy of the lame duck isn't too bad at all.
Perhaps we ought to cook the duck like the Chinese.
Well, again, back to our previous discussion, it has nothing to do with the duck, but you see, you need analogies to describe human situations, and so So you naturally turn around to nature, but the most interesting part of nature is the animal kingdom. And again, I think that it adds color. You could describe in a whole paragraph what happens to the politician. But if you say lame duck, somehow you dramatize it and you see this poor little critter.
I don't know about the politicians being poor.
Well, I tell you, politicians, I think, for the most part, don't get paid very much, and that's one of the problems of our time. I mean, to run a campaign costs you millions of dollars, and how are you going to get it? And that, you've got to be nice to people. And then we criticize others, but if we were to run for office, how would you finance all of that? So this is one of the dilemmas of our political life, you know, lame or non-lame duck.
Although I must say some politicians do appear to be babbling constantly. Otto, for people who want to elevate the level of political rhetoric, would you have any practical suggestions?
Well, elevate political rhetoric. I mean, rhetoric is rhetoric, however elevated. You mean the political discussion. I think that the market more or less tends to determine the level of the rhetoric. If a politician is talking with thoughtful people with a sense of complexities, if she or he engages in stupid rhetoric, it's not going to fly. So the politician, if successful, as any merchandiser, has to attune himself or herself to the audience. On the other hand, if you've got a bunch of people who go for rhetoric, then the politician's going to play rhetoric. I think it's a question of supply and demand.
And on that, we'll end this segment of the discussion on animal rights and language. I think that's very apropos. Tune in for part three, next edition at 10:25 a.m. Thanks for listening.
So that was, there were three parts to that, and I think we we didn't play the first one, and I'll get that, because I'm dealing with over 1,500 audio interviews that I did in the U.S., Canada, Australia, and New Zealand. Excuse me. So we're transferring a lot of that and rare stuff. And then also our video stuff. This is a growing issue that people are finally recognizing. We are seeing this, what I call the bicycle lobby, who are promoting special rights, privileges, and exemptions. We see signs all over, at least here in California, motorists who are driving on four wheels are expected to share the road. But the bicyclists are not shouldering any responsibility. And we just had a proposition on the statewide ballot here in this last November election where they snuck in a clause in a proposition to fund the state parks. And there was something in there for bicycles. And as soon as I saw that, I voted against it. And a lot of people didn't recognize that. And the sneaky bicycle people, bicycle lobby, did not talk about that. All you saw on ads were these beautiful state parks, but nothing about the bicyclists who expect special rights for them, but they don't want to pay for anything. Now, those of us who grew up with the three-wheel tricycles remember that it had the little ringing bell on it, and you didn't have backlights, but you had warnings for pedestrians to get out of your way. Of course, your kids, too. But today, and we just had an incident last Sunday where we were walking along Ocean Beach, which was a warm day, and bicyclists are there and pedestrians are there. A lot of people were out at the beach. It's a famous area where it's the end point for termination point for the Bay to Breakers races. But anyway, bicyclists ride on the roads, and they ride on the dirt sidewalks. Anyway, this bicyclist comes roaring down toward us and knocks my old lady down and injures her. And then he tries to flee, and we get into a scuffle to restrain him until the police could come and broke glasses and all kinds of things. And they called a woman the N-word, a black woman who saw the episode, and several people came over. Unfortunately for him, we caught it on videotape, and apparently the videotape video camera was still running while this scuffle was going on, and the injury and people and I was injured, and my old lady was knocked on the ground, and he threw the bicycle on her. Anyway, she's now got first of the medical bill. She had to go to the hospital, $1,400 for an ambulance. So this is a medical expense, all caused by bicyclists who may not have insurance. And then the hospital bill she hasn't gotten yet. But anyway, there are people who are concerned about this anarchy on the road, what I call damn reckless bicyclists, who drive around, who ride around at night with no red light on their the rear of their bicycle, no headlight on the front of their bicycle. They go through stop signs, they violate the red lights, they pull into traffic, and when you complain to them, the more obnoxious among them will smash your mirror or scratch your vehicle, or there have been a case involving a commercial truck where the guy claimed that he was hit, and so he lies down in the middle of the street blocking traffic until the police come so he can, quote, document a bicycle truck motor vehicle accident. So this is the kind of things that some of them are doing. And then we have a thing called critical mass, where on the last Friday of the month, these what I call anarchists gather together, and they block the major roads and the main entrance to the major freeways and highways. And, of course, people are furious because they not only because they do it at rush hour on a Friday, but if there are no emergency vehicles can get through and no police vehicles can get through. And so if somebody has a heart attack or something and an ambulance has to get through, they can't because these damn bicyclists have in their critical mass public disobedience have blocked traffic. There's this myth, it's one of these political fictions, that American cities are designed for bicycles. They're not. This is not Europe. This is not Amsterdam. This is not Copenhagen. Places, old famous European cities, which were designed for horses, and later when bicycles, the automobile came later to a lot of these cities. Now, there is room for bicyclists in the cities, and certainly in the parks and along the beaches, but they have got to be responsible. And in the, at least in the California Rules of the Road Motor Vehicle Driver's License book, there is a section which orders bicyclists to obey the rules of the roads, and it lays it out. And motorists are expected to respect them when they're in these bicycle lanes. So all the onus and responsibility are on people who drive and who pay insurance. A lot of these people, most of them, I suspect, do not have any insurance and wouldn't buy it if they could afford it. Now, this is interesting. I talked to an insurance company about is a bicycle a homeowner with, or a renter who has renter's insurance or homeowner's insurance, are they covered if they have a bicycle? And I was told yes, so I want to see the section. The insurance code. So this is going on across the country, and the claim is we've got to get people out of their cars so the world will be more green. Well, the only green that's coming out of this political agenda is the people who sell bicycles and the people who are pushing this agenda. The roads aren't safer, the sideways aren't safer, and when the bicyclist gets injured by a motor vehicle, a bus, or a train, it's hundreds of thousands of dollars. We've just had a case where a bicyclist was turned in front of a bus, and the settlement was about $500,000 out of the city coffers. So we're seeing these things more and more, and the bicyclists who violate the rules of the road, those who do it, are collecting big jury awards, large insurance settlements, and guess who pays for that? Now, there are cases where motorists have run down bicycles in anger or made, you know, a mistake while driving. So we take notice of that also. So, but this is going on across the country. The other issue is, you know, if you have a motor vehicle or a motorcycle or a scooter, every jurisdiction requires yearly or bi-yearly registration, but not bicycles in California. I heard it's optional. We still kind of nail that down. But there are states like Alabama, Vermont, other states that require bicycle license plates and bicyclists to buy license plates if they want to ride on public thoroughfares. So this is a source of revenue that's been ignored, and it's time that people start realizing, hey, people who drive cars, whether for pleasure, for work, or for both, have to pay big fees and increasing fees to be on the roads and the highways, but not the bicycle. It's time to make them, they want to share the road, then they have to shoulder and pocket some of the responsibility. So if you've got that situation in your jurisdiction, it's time to stand up, speak out, and stand firm, because these people can be very act like a bunch of thugs and accuse you of being politically incorrect, insensitive, and you don't understand, and all the other Saul Alinsky BS that they spout when they're challenged for their special rights, privileges, and exemption agenda. So, but if you just grumble in private and let them get away with it in public, then you deserve what you get. You get no sympathy, and you don't expect it. Let's see, what else is going on here? on the marijuana thing. This is interesting. We had a bust here in San Francisco, finally, of a guy who's accused of, he's gay and politico, and he was pushing drugs for teenagers. And he set up this so-called medical dispensary for people who were suffering from cancer. This was several years ago. Well, they had a trailer parked across the street from his so-called medical marijuana dispensary on Market Street, and they were filming the people who were going in there. And the people who were going in there were these teenagers, and somebody remarked, hey, we've got a big increase among teenagers of cancer. Well, what was going on was that they were going in there and being hustled for sex, the boys were. The people running the dispensary were being paid up to $500 a week in cash, plus all the pot they could smoke. So this is what's going on. This is one of the reasons why this was defeated. And there'll be more on this, because the Harvey Milk, St. Harvey Milk agenda is coming up this month. It was a horrible incident in San Francisco and California history. But there have been many myths about Harvey Milk. Among them was he did join the Navy, or was signed in when he was 17 and a half. He claimed in his biography that he was gay at the time. He served honorably, given that credit. So how is it that these people today who are now out of the service, who have risen through the ranks, did their service, served honorably, and gotten their VA benefits and all of that, now suddenly you say there's something wrong with the military and the ban on open, the politicization of sexual preference is what I call. There's a disconnect here. But anyway, Harvey Milk, when he came to San Francisco, set up this little camera shop on Castro and Market, and we'll put up the pictures of it. You wouldn't believe this. And I encountered him when he had that shop. He ran an ad. I had some film I wanted to develop, and he ran an ad with a coupon. So I brought my film over there. It was destroyed, and I confronted him about it, and he got up in my face, and I got down on his head. And so, I never liked him after that incident and some of the things that he did in the city. He was called the mayor of Castro Street because he was running drugs, illegal drugs, out of that camera shop. Supposed camera shop. It's now, ironically, a shop that sells the New York Times and other out-of-town newspapers. I don't know where they put the newspapers, because it's just a hole in the wall. But anyway, Dan White, there's going to be some revisionist history coming up on him. We also have the Jim Jones, Jonestown anniversary coming up. And there's going to be some revelations, some revisionist history coming up on that. So, some of us have been around and seen all this stuff, and they tried to shut us up, have not succeeded, and will not succeed. And even if they do shut up some of us, there will always be some people who were there who have a very vivid memory and a very accurate memory of what really went on and what these people today are trying to do to cover up all of the transgressions and abuses of people they thought couldn't fight back, wouldn't fight back, or shouldn't fight back. So, be that as it may, I'm still having a little problem here. So, let's just play a little music, and because I don't know what to do with Yahoo, I'm going to have to complain to them. Oh, let's hear Will Rogers, because this is very appropriate. here. Huh. Yeah, this is what's happening with Yahoo. Doggone it. I don't know. Well, let's see what else we have. Well, here's an original version. Let's end with this. Original version of John Philip Sousa playing his most famous march. Processing that you hear today, but that's the original stuff with Gusto. Getting back to Harding, Sousa was around at the time President Harding was in the White House, but he didn't write anything for Harding. One, I meant to bring this up, that and kind of revisiting Harding, Warren G. Harding, the G standard meant Gamliel, G-A-M-L-I-E-L. Now, there's no such name. What had happened was, not only was Harding supposedly our first president with African ancestry and not Obama, that's BS, Harding was accused of that many times, and what he said was, I can't help it if some of my ancestors jumped over the back fence. There was also a table in the White House. Harding was had an affair with Nan Britton, I think, and it was called the Lay of the Land. This is what I was told by some people who were around at that time of the era. And there are some writings. Anyway, one of the things about Harding that has not been brought up, several things. He started the Bureau of the Budget. He was the first president to use to make a radio broadcast, a big radio broadcast. His was the first election to be the election results were broadcast. Also, what he did with the military. Now, the Americans, young Americans had come back from Europe and were tired of war and they wanted to get on with their lives. And, of course, we've had, there was a, veterans were promised a bonus and that blew up during Harding's administration, Hoover's administration, the bonus marchers and the bonus camps. And Douglas MacArthur was commander in chief of the chief of staff, and Hoover ordered him to disperse the bonus marchers, protesters. And that was a big splotch on General Douglas MacArthur's history. But anyway, Harding started the Navy was he had a Secretary of State, Kellogg, Frank Kellogg. No, I don't think he was related to Kellogg Cornflakes, who started the disarmament talks, the Washington Naval disarmament talks, and with the French Foreign Minister Aristide Briand, and they came up with a formula for the Navy, for the navies of the world, 5-5-3. The British and the Americans were to have five ships to the third, the three of the Italians and the Japanese. The Japanese didn't like that. Of course, they got their revenge on December 7th. Anyway, they didn't go along with this deal, and the Italians were not happy. But anyway, ships that were built for, as battleships were converted to aircraft carriers. This is not known. And the early, we at the beginning of World War II, we had, I think it was seven aircraft carriers that were, a couple of them were former, started out, the keels were laid down as battleships. And I think it was the Saratoga, the Essex, the Enterprise, the Wasp. Let's see, what was the other one? Oh, gosh. It escapes me, but I'll bring it up. But a couple of these ships were originally, they were going to be battleships, and so they had to scrap that. And so the, so instead of having these battleships, because nobody thought about aircraft carriers at the time, and it was General Billy Mitchell, after World War II, who kept promoting air power, could sink a battleship. And then the battleship admirals opposed him, and this led to the court-martial of Billy Mitchell, which we'll get into next month. But anyway, what had happened was there, the German Navy, which was the Imperial Fleet, had to be broken up. So some sailed to, were forced to sail and surrender at Scapa Flow for the Brits. We got two of the ships, the Ostfriesland, which was used as a target ship. And the Navy Admiral said, well, airplanes can't sink ships. And Billy Mitchell proved that they could, and he kept pushing this, and he wouldn't shut up, and so they court-martialed him. But there was a famous movie, The Court Martial of Billy Mitchell, starring Gary Cooper, and it's a great film, and it's very accurate. And in fact, today, Mitchell Field in Wisconsin, the airport there, is named after General Billy Mitchell. And during World War II, there was a bomber, the Mitchell bomber, B-25, was named after him. So he was part of that era, but Harding did do something for our defense, even though he never served in the military, as many of our presidents didn't. So that's a little known thing about Warren G. Harding. Of course, everybody knows about scandals and the attorney general who went to jail, Harold Daugherty, Teapot Dome, which has a San Francisco connection to the Ninth Circuit. We'll get into that another day. It's a lot of fascinating history. I hope you enjoy it. If you have suggestions, you can email me at Veritas, pverzola, V-E-R-Z-O-L-A, at gmail.com. I'll put it up. And go to our YouTube sites, Amicus Veritas, A-M-I-C-U-S-V-E-R-I-T-A-S, YouTube. We have a one that's devoted to animals and slice of life. Swamp Fox Humor, also YouTube. And then we're going to be focusing on this bicycle issue. So I'm glad we could make it through with all the problems I've had with YouTube for the last day. Not YouTube, but Yahoo. And we hope to be on Monday, and we'll bring up that Wehrmacht general who may have been Jewish. So this is Peter Paul Verzola, and we'll end with where is it? It won't be Taps. I'll just play a little bit of this.
What do you say, Ben? Want a hand?
No, you guys go ahead. I got too much on my mind to play poker.
King bets.
cost you five. Tony, up to you.
Say, Tony, what are you
going to
do?
I'm in for the boy.
So am I.
Likewise.
Me too.
Well, people, it's Peter Paul Rizzola. Thanks for listening.